This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Tune in to Bread and Roses on Friday, January 6th, for a discussion of Tom Hartman's 10 Steps to Restore Democracy to America, and what do we need to do for the coming year. If you like to engage in talk radio, we're inviting your calls this Friday at 6 p.m. as we examine and comment on Hartman's A Declaration of Rights for the 21st Century. That's on Bread and Roses this Friday at 6 p.m.
Bread and Roses, as we come marching, we march to four men.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Amin Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Dillanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. Justice Department issued a report today on the mistaken arrest of Portland attorney Brandon Mayfield.
The Rhode Island House of Representatives yesterday voted to override the veto of a medical marijuana legislation measure.
Although Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had additional surgery today, they say he is showing significant improvement.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,193 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,263 Iraqi civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 6, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
I'm Annalisa Hummel. The U.S. Justice Department issued a report today on the mistaken arrest of Portland attorney Brandon Mayfield. KBOO's Andy Seaton has the story.
The U.S. Justice Department Inspector General has issued a report on the arrest of Portland attorney Brandon Mayfield. Mayfield was mistakenly arrested and held as a material witness in the 2004 Madrid train bombings. The report detailed the fingerprint error that led to his arrest. However, the Justice Department report said, quote, "We did not find any evidence that the FBI misused any provisions of the Patriot Act in conducting its investigation," end quote. This was technically correct because Mayfield was held under material witness provisions which are not part of the Patriot Act. Karen Immergut, the U.S. Attorney for Oregon, said, quote, "The FBI did not initiate its investigation of Brandon Mayfield because of his Muslim faith," end quote. Immergut went on to say that the U.S. Patriot Act is a critical tool in their ability to combat terrorism. Attorney Eldon Rosenthal represented Mayfield and describes the circumstances of Mayfield's arrest.
Mr. Mayfield was arrested in May of 2004 as a material witness in the tragic bombings in Madrid. And 2 weeks later, he was released when the Spanish National Police confirmed the identity of a Mr. Daoud as the actual perpetrator of the crime.
Rosenthal went on to react to today's report.
The Inspector General's report today underscores the reason that civil liberties cannot take a back seat to the war on terror. You know, the Bush administration is asking for more and more powers to wiretap, to eavesdrop, to look in somebody's library records and so forth. And they're saying, trust us, we'll protect your civil liberties. This report underscores what really happens, because here the FBI made a terrible mistake, a terrible fingerprint mistake, decided Mr. Mayfield was their terrorist, and then, according to the Inspector General's report, violated his civil rights by misleading a federal judge here in Oregon in order to arrest him and in order to search his house and his law firm. Every American should worry, should be concerned that this could happen to them, because Mr. Mayfield was innocent. He had done nothing wrong. He was the victim of a mistake. And then even though the government didn't have probable cause to arrest him, they misled a federal judge into believing that they did.
Brandon Mayfield is still suing the government over his mistaken arrest and detention. I'm Andy Seaton, KBO News.
This week, new statistics out of Iraq showed an escalating rate of violence. An Iraqi Interior Ministry official said Wednesday more than 7,000 Iraqis, most of them civilians, were killed in 2005. It was the first year that Iraqi officials have kept such records. And yesterday, bombs killed at least 120 Iraqis and 7 U.S. soldiers. It was impossible to confirm the accuracy of the numbers because many slayings in Iraq go unreported and there are no other official figures with which to compare them. The U.S. military does not track civilian deaths. On the phone to talk about the deterioration of the U.S. presence in Iraq is Portland Peaceful Response Coalition activist Will Seaman. He's in downtown Portland right now with the PPRC's weekly vigil. Thanks for being with us, Will.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Will, what's your take on the new Iraq death count?
Well, I think you summed it up very well. It is a very frightening document in what it covers, but of course what's even more frightening is what it doesn't cover. They, of course, rely on news reports exclusively. And one of the things that's most dramatic about this conflict in Iraq right now is that it is one of the rare wars in which it has become impossible to report on. And that is to say, you're either embedded with U.S. troops, which is going to constrain what you're going to be able to see, especially when it comes to the casualties of this more aggressive air war that is being reported on. That is, many of the people being killed today are being killed in these airstrikes that we only hear about in those odd events that some other means are available to report on them. But just in terms of this limited scope of this report, it's a very frightening report. And, of course, what has to be the focus of our concern are these statistics, like that the U.S.-led forces were the sole killers of 37% of the civilian victims in Iraq. And we know that that's just a fraction of the total number of victims of this conflict.
Is there any way?
So this is, of course, why we're out here every week on Fridays as a part of this vigil, as a part of this protest against the war and a call for bringing the U.S. troops, for ending the U.S. war in Iraq.
Where do you think the U.S. presence is going during the next year?
It's very difficult to know. Of course, everything depends upon how the U.S. public responds to the deterioration of the situation in Iraq. And really, more particularly, we need to be holding our elected officials accountable. And by that, of course, I mean the one party that could conceivably be the voice against this war and occupation, the Democratic Party. We need to be putting pressure on those folks. They are clearly in a position with these midterm elections to put tremendous pressure on the Bush administration and the Republican Party in general. That could bring about a hastened withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, but only if the U.S. public becomes active in this struggle.
And when is the next big demonstration that people should know about?
I'm really glad you asked me about that. We are already, the planning is already going forward with dozens of organizations involved in the planning for the March 19th. That is, of course, you know, the third anniversary of this horrendous war and occupation. And already, like I say, dozens of organizations have begun planning that event, which we hope will be yet another record-breaking peace rally in March, another really loud and strong call to end this war, to change the direction of our country's foreign policy.
All right. Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
That was Will Seaman of Portland Peaceful Response Coalition. You can find out more about their work at portlandpeacefulresponse.org.
Frustrated with the limited resources available to them, people experiencing homelessness in Portland, Oregon, have created their own version of transitional housing. It's called Dignity Village, and 5 years after its inception, the community is negotiating a lease with the city of Portland to keep their place on city property. KBOO's Julie Sabatier has more from FSRN.
With overcrowded shelters and at least 2,000 people on the streets each night, Portland's homeless population was desperate for alternatives. This is how Dignity Village was born. The village can house up to 60 people, and it serves many more than that during the day, offering bathrooms, showers, phone and internet service.
This is a very important program. It's not the total answer to homelessness, but it's the answer to my homelessness.
Shreisler Chelly has been a Dignity Village resident for 2 years and currently serves as the building coordinator. She says she feels very safe in the community that is helping her to get back on her feet after a drug addiction put her on the streets. Dignity Village began as a tent city underneath the Fremont Bridge. 5 years later, this self-governed community is negotiating an official lease for the city property it shares with the Sunderland Recycling Facility.
We've always been informally have a gentleman's handshake, so to speak, with the city. And this way, what gives us the parameters of what we can actually do here and what we can't do.
That's Tim McCarthy, a Dignity Village resident who serves as outreach coordinator and treasurer for the community. He says negotiations are going well, but ultimately, he would like to see the village purchase land for a more permanent location. Dignity Village is currently situated between the Portland Airport and Columbia River Correctional Facility. A lot of the residents say they would like to see it move, but right now, they are concentrating on creating more durable structures that comply with the city's evolving fire and safety codes for transitional housing. As the building coordinator, Chelly is in charge of demolishing the yurts built on pallets and affectionately known as train wrecks.
They were built with whatever recycled materials that people could scrounge. Those were not structurally sound, they weren't sanitary, and they weren't safe. They were also a fire hazard. We now are building standardized building houses. We use all recycled materials again, always. We're held to a code standard that they're currently building at BDS. It's the Bureau of Development Services.
Roland Schlepowski is a policy advisor for Commissioner Sam Adams of Portland City Council. He says code compliance is only one part of the city's goals for Dignity Village.
Basically, the thing that we are most interested in is we want to get data. We will expect to get information on how the operations are there and who's moving through. We would hope that everyone will be able to find permanent, more traditional housing than Dignity Village.
Schlepowski says the data will help the city with their 10-year plan to end homelessness. He also says he understands that some residents are more transitional than others. Those elected to the village council are committed to a year, but many of them say it is worth it to sustain the community. Again, Tim McCarthy.
Dignity Village is not just about the people that live in Dignity Village. We're about the homeless worldwide and nationwide. We believe that we have a model that other cities could learn from.
Tent cities have popped up in American cities from Seattle to Fort Lauderdale, though not many places have chosen to negotiate with the homeless the way Portland has. Schlepowski explains.
We give them some land and we help them out with certain utility issues, but in the end, they are largely self-sufficient, and that means that it's a really good deal for the Portland taxpayer.
Sustained by private donations and grants, Dignity Village is not financially dependent on government funds. Chelly explains how this empowers people to help themselves.
You can go into the shelter system and there's no expectation of you except line up, come in when we tell you to, get up and leave when we tell you to. At Dignity Village, there's an immediate expectation. You have to support your community. You are expected to do a rent exchange here in your good labor. Then there's an expectation that this is not permanent. This is not forever. Figure it out, get back together, and get on with your life.
For FSRN, I'm Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6, hear Bread and Roses. At 7, Essence of Soul with Shahid Hamid. Tonight's weather, showers with lows in the low 40s. Tomorrow, a chance of showers in the morning, then rain in the afternoon with highs in the upper 40s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Nobel laureate Joseph E. Stiglitz and Harvard budget expert Linda Bilmes plan to present this week a paper estimating the cost of the Iraq War at between $1 to $2 trillion. This is far higher than earlier estimates from $1 to $200 billion. In a paper presented to this week's Allied Social Sciences Association annual meeting in Boston, they calculate that the war is likely to cost the United States a minimum of nearly $1 trillion and potentially over $2 trillion. The study expands on traditional budgetary estimates by including costs such as lifetime disability and health care for the over 16,000 injured, one-fifth of whom have serious brain or spinal injuries. It goes on to analyze the costs to the economy, including the economic value of lives lost and the impact of factors such as higher oil prices that can be partially attributed to the conflict in Iraq. The paper also calculates the impact on the economy if a proportion of the money spent on the Iraq war were spent in other ways, including on investments in the United States.
The National Security Agency, the top secret spy shop that has been secretly eavesdropping on Americans under a plan authorized by President Bush 4 years ago, destroyed the names of thousands of U.S. citizens and companies and the data it collected on them. They did this because the agency feared it would be taken to task by lawmakers for conducting unlawful surveillance on United States citizens without authorization from a court, according to a little-known report published in October 2001. NSA lawyers advised the agency to immediately destroy the names of thousands of American citizens and businesses it collected data on shortly after 9/11 in its quest to target terrorists in this country. NSA lawyers told the agency that the surveillance was illegal and that it could not share the data it collected with the CIA or other intelligence agencies. By law, the NSA cannot spy on a U.S. citizen, an immigrant lawfully admitted to this country for permanent residence, or a U.S. corporation.
Democrats haven't completely given up the notion of filibustering Samuel Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court, though they're certainly not talking about it before his confirmation hearings. Alito, a longtime conservative lawyer and judge, will face the Senate Judiciary Committee on Monday for his confirmation hearings to become the 110th Supreme Court Justice, replacing retiring Sandra Day O'Connor. The Senate's majority Republicans are pushing for a final confirmation vote January 20th if Democrats don't filibuster his nomination. The Democrats contend Alito is too conservative and could undermine some rights if confirmed. Some of their liberal supporters have urged Democrats to do whatever they can to block the nomination, including a filibuster. Republicans say they're ready to fight if the Democrats try a partisan filibuster, including the so-called nuclear option, which would let the GOP ban judicial filibusters.
The Florida Supreme Court yesterday ruled that Governor Jeb Bush's private school voucher program violates the state constitution's promise of a, quote, uniform system of free public schools. The ruling is considered a major blow to Governor Bush's seven-year public education overhaul in Florida. Free Speech Radio News' Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
Watched nationwide, the 5-2 decision topples Opportunity Scholarships, the only statewide voucher program in the country. And it also raises doubts about two related voucher programs that Florida employs. National organizations who both support and oppose vouchers had filed friend-of-the-court briefs in the case. Elliot Mintzberg is with People for the American Way. He says Thursday's ruling could have a major impact on other school voucher programs across the country.
Because it is yet another example of a state Supreme Court rejecting vouchers under state constitutional provisions. We've seen a number of those decisions in Colorado, in Maine, and other places, and I think it ought to send a message to the voucher movement that rather than trying schemes that violate state constitutions and drain resources from the public schools, the focus ought to be on improving the public schools.
Legal scholars say there are no grounds for Bush to appeal successfully to the U.S. Supreme Court. There are no federal issues involved. But Bush did not rule out an appeal and vowed to pursue every strategy to keep vouchers alive, including raising money from private sources. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Defying the state's governor, the Rhode Island House of Representatives yesterday voted 59-13 to override the veto of a medical marijuana legislation measure approved earlier this year. This, according to the News Standard. In so doing, the nation's smallest state joined 10 others in bucking the federal government's Supreme Court-backed prohibition against using the herbal plant even for medicinal purposes. According to the Marijuana Policy Project, the state is just the third in the nation to shield medical marijuana users from prosecution via the legislative process. Voters in 8 other states have used ballot initiatives to force their state governments to enact such laws. Rhode Island is also the first to pass medical marijuana legislation since a Supreme Court ruling last year. The ruling says that state laws permitting medicinal use of marijuana do not shield users from arrest or prosecution by the federal government.
It's 5:21. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Shh. What's that sound? Nothing. It's silence you hear. Blessed silence. That's probably because your home telephone is no longer ringing ceaselessly with a barrage of infuriating telemarketing solicitations, most of which came as you were sitting down to dinner or doing anything more enjoyable than trying to fend off some huckster on the phone. The welcome change from intrusive commercial cacophony to a soothing quietude in your own home has come in only 2 years' time, and it came because ordinary folks like you demanded it. In 2003, hawkers of everything from credit cards to aluminum siding were making 104 million calls every day into our homes. Fed up, millions of Americans shrieked in unison, "Stop it!" The opposition was so broad and so intense that even Washington couldn't ignore it. Plus, Congress critters were also getting the irritating calls at their homes, so they could identify with the public instead of the industry for a change. The result was the creation of the National Do Not Call Registry. By going to donotcall.gov or by calling 888-382-1222, you can put your phone number on the registry and essentially ban telemarketers from calling you. Since 2003, when the registry opened for business, 109 million Americans have added their phone numbers to it. Thus, the refreshing sound all across the country of phones not ringing. The ban is not total. For example, any company from which you've bought something can call you. But you can tell them to put you on their own do not call list, and they must stop calling. You can also simply refuse to give out your phone number when store checkout clerks ask for it. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep saying no to telemarketers, contact the Electronic Privacy Information Center, 202-483-1140. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
There's guarded optimism from the doctors treating Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Although, after additional surgery today, they say Sharon is showing significant improvement. But Sharon will be kept in a coma at least until Sunday. And for now, they won't be able to tell just how much damage he suffered in Wednesday's stroke. Independent medical experts say the prognosis doesn't look good. One specialist at a hospital in London says today's operation to remove blood and relieve swelling in Sharon's brain is probably a last desperate attempt to salvage something. Doctors already stopped bleeding from Sharon's brains once after Wednesday's massive stroke. However, experts say it is less likely Sharon will recover the more times that procedure is done. That's the KABU Evening News for Friday, January 6th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kabu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kvu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer and tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporter Andy Seaton, our engineer D.R. Garrett, and the Cable Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7:30, it's More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. They'll be taking your calls on a wide variety of issues currently in the news. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Ellen Cutler, author of Micro Miracles, Discover the Healing Power of Enzymes. She uses enzymes to treat allergies, asthma, fatigue, chronic pain, and many other ailments. At 10:30, Glenn Andreessen discusses which vegetable seeds can and should be started January through March. At 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And at 6 p.m. on Monday night, tune in for Labor Radio and look what's likely to be on the Oregon ballot in November. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Camus said, "Don't wait for the last judgment. It takes place every day."
Good night, Liam.
Good night, Annalisa.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 6th of January, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A Connecticut tribe is among those that have been watching with keen interest as Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff's fate plays out. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
Last October, the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs revoked federal recognition for two Connecticut tribes, including the Scaticoke Tribal Nation. Tribal Chief Richard Velke believes the BIA decision was made because of the undue influence of lobbyists.
We all see what's happening today in the Washington, D.C. area, where Abramoff and the indictments that are going on today. And we can't help but feel, but some way or another, that it doesn't stop there, that it has a longer arm, and it did involve the Scaticoke Tribal Nation in its final reconsidered final determination also.
Velke says he hopes information about this might be discovered when his tribe takes its case against the BIA to federal court next week. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
The Bush administration has released $100 million in emergency funding to states under the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which helps low-income residents pay for heating bills. But as Charles Michael Ray reports, in South Dakota, members of the Oglala Sioux tribe are questioning how low-income aid is administered.
The Oglala Sioux tribe has declared a heating emergency. An administrative official with the tribe, Edgar Bear Runner, says loads of firewood and extra donations are helping. But Bear Runner says an average low-income family on Pine Ridge will still receive less federal assistance than the same family would get in other parts of the state.
The amount of money that we got doesn't compare to our neighboring counties in South Dakota. There's disparities in services. There's a lack of adequate funds to address our energy problems here on the res.
Bear Runner says the reservations in South Dakota are being left behind, despite treaty obligations. But the Deputy Secretary for the South Dakota Department of Social Services, Kim Molson-Risden, says the formula being used by the tribe to allocate heating assistance benefits may be the cause of any differences. Molson-Risden adds that applications for heating assistance have risen statewide over the last year. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
Moving from a reservation to the city can be tough for Native Americans. Those who make the change while battling addictions often end up homeless. In Seattle, there's a shelter exclusively for Natives, where people from more than 100 different tribes gather for support. As Kathy Duchamp reports, the shelter is now expanding into a cultural center.
Mugs of coffee warm the hands of 100 or so people who come each morning to the Chief Seattle Club. Thomas Anderson is a regular. Born in Alaska, Anderson heard about the club from a fellow Native living on the streets.
He told me about the place, and I said, cool, nothing but Natives, let's go.
Why is that important to have a place for Natives?
Because it's a family. It's some place we can go and be safe, feel better about ourselves. Because when you're living on the streets, there's not too much.
The Chief Seattle Club offers community and services for homeless natives. Soon, it will offer much more.
We're looking here at the Monterey Hotel. It's an old hotel built in the 1920s. The basement and the first floor will make up the Chief Seattle Club.
Sister Julie Codd is the resource coordinator for the club. She stands outside a building that will become the club's new home. There will be more meals, more services, also a sacred gathering circle, and an art studio for people to carve and bead. The Chief Seattle Club operates with private donations instead of state and federal funds. So unlike other Indian organizations in the Northwest, the club will continue to serve Native people exclusively.
You know, they say that we should be including many other groups and cultural groups, but I think that it, when people are so down and out, they do need a place to heal and become their own person again and live a more balanced life in order to take in other differences.
Sister Julie hopes the expanded club will enable urban natives to move on with their lives, but she expects many to stay and teach. I'm Kathy Duchamp in Seattle.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week, a special holiday edition of Counterspin featuring a show-length interview with the education expert, Jonathan Kozol. Kozol will join us to talk about media coverage of education and his new book, Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. In his new book, Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America, Jonathan Kozol draws a grim picture of U.S. public schools, particularly those in poor urban neighborhoods. He graphically reports on the decaying infrastructure, the underspending and overcrowding, the lack of art and music teachers, librarians, doctors, many of the things that are taken for granted in better-off, whiter public schools. But the central theme of Kozol's book, the theme that seems to connect these other troubling factors, is race. Kozol argues that racial segregation in public schools is beyond critical, perhaps as bad as it was three decades ago, with some formerly integrated schools becoming resegregated. Jonathan Kozol is the author of many books about education, among them Amazing Grace and Savage Inequalities. He joins us now by phone from Massachusetts. Welcome to Counterspin, Jonathan Kozol.
Thanks for having me. And I might say quickly, it's not simply that segregation has returned with a vengeance to public education. It's worse than it's been at any time since 1968. I notice in introducing me, you said perhaps worse. There's no question that it's worse. We now have fewer black kids going to integrated schools than at any time since the year that Dr. King was assassinated. And you know, I've just visited 60 schools over the past 5 years in the inner city schools. It's not just that they're kind of segregated. They're absolutely segregated. I never see white children. I mean, if you took a photograph of the typical class that I visit in any of our major inner cities, that photo would look exactly like a photograph of a class of black kids in Mississippi 50 years ago. You know, in New York, to take a glaring example, because that's the most segregated state for public schools in America. In New York, 7 out of 8 black kids go to segregated schools. You know, the real heartbreaker for a guy like me who grew up in the age of Dr. King and who actually sat at his feet and remembers his words is that when I visit any city I've never been to before, black folks, in a kind of bitter joke, always say to me, if you want to see a really segregated school while you're here, just ask for one that's named for Dr. King, because typically the worst, most segregated, most underfunded, overcrowded, and academically failing schools are named for Dr. King or for Rosa Parks or for Thurgood Marshall. I always wonder why we name these horrible schools for people that black folks love. I always think we ought to name them for people that they don't like.
Well, Jonathan, you mentioned in an interview in Salon.com that this was perhaps the angriest book you have ever written. You've been writing about education for many decades. Is the anger, does that stem from the fact that things seem to just be getting worse?
Not solely, though that's part of it. I mean, we're dealing with profoundly resegregated schools, but also grossly unequal schools. And since I'm close to the kids I write about, especially kids in California, with whom I've spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, and kids in the South Bronx, I don't see this as a question of numbers. I see it as real children that I know, little kids I know in the South Bronx in New York City, which is still the poorest congressional district in America, get about $11,000 a year for their public education. If you lift them up and plunk them down in a really wealthy suburb of New York like Manhasset, which is, for those elsewhere in the nation, is sort of a classic super-rich white suburb where probably a lot of my Harvard classmates live. If you took one of these little kids who's now getting $11,000 a year in the South Bronx for her education, and you plunked her down in Manhasset, she'd be getting $22,000 a year. So if you know these children, you can't help but be angry. I'm too old at the age of 69 to bite my tongue. I don't try to soften my words in order to appease the people in the media who orchestrate acceptable opinion. Typically, the mainstream press, even the allegedly liberal press, praises my books but says that I'm too impatient, that I'm not stating this with enough understatement and civility. And civility has come to be a code word for a kind of suffocating, stifling of your real feelings. But I'm too old to play that game. I don't care, you know, what price the white press makes me pay. I'm going to say what I believe now for the rest of my life. I'm not going to pull my punches on this issue because this is an atrocity. I mean, I go into these schools and I look around the room and I see, you know, I visit high schools that have 4,000 or 5,000 kids and at most maybe 3 or 4 white kids in the whole building. And I try to tell myself that, you know, this is what Dr. King and Rosa Parks lived and died for. It's not just that we've ripped apart the legacy for which they lived, ripped apart the legacy of Brown, but that our media, with a few notable exceptions, absolutely refuse to name this reality. They will do anything they can to steer around this truth, especially when they're speaking about schools in their own community. Typically, even the best newspapers, like the New York Times, will deplore segregation as a national phenomenon. They're always in favor of integration, except when it comes to New York. And then when they speak of their own hometown, they suddenly dodge the issue altogether, and they come up with these sweeteners, such as when the New York Times describes a school that has 50% black kids, 45% Latino kids, and maybe 5% kids from Pakistan or Southeast Asia. They won't say this is a segregated school. Instead, they say, this is a school with many minorities, but a diverse population. And there's nothing diverse about it at all. Diverse has come to be a synonym for segregated. And to me, the shame of the nation is not simply that we've reverted to the old order of Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal decision of 1896, that actually haven't even lived up to Plessy because our schools are segregated, but they're not anywhere near equal. But the real shame of the nation is that the responsible, influential media, those who orchestrate acceptable opinion, refuse to name this reality and lack the guts to confront it. There are a few newspapers which should be named as notable exceptions. Newsday, which is a newspaper on Long Island outside New York, has been excellent and honest about this. And so too the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which has been heroic on this subject, but very few other newspapers in America.
Jonathan Kozol, your books sell well. Shame of the Nation is selling well now, Amazing Grace, Savage Inequalities, and yet you just named a small handful of newspapers that you say are doing a good job. Why is it you think that the arguments that you make in these books about education, besides very sporadically, don't make it into the ongoing national debate about education?
Well, that's not entirely true. What I've discovered is that this new book, for example, The Shame of the Nation, is having a dynamic impact upon those who actually work in the front lines of our public schools. When I visited 25 cities this fall to talk about the book, I had the largest audiences I've ever seen since 1968, which was the high point of the civil rights movement, typically in cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and Seattle and New York City. Crowds of 1,500 people will turn out, and two-thirds of them are teachers. And they respond to this with indignation. In fact, I always pass around a sign-up sheet for people in the audience who don't want to simply, you know, sit there and have a one-time evening of moral indignation, but want to do something about it. And if there are 1,500 people in the audience, typically 500, 600, 700 sign up, and they add comments like, "When do we start?" When, by start, they mean when do we start mobilizing to change this? There's tremendous response among teachers, and that's why the book has become a bestseller, and also among really decent, thoughtful academic people. So, you know, thank God, the kind of censorship that I've undergone from the major media like the New York Times and a few other papers that have that influence isn't able to cut me off from my real audience. Still, it's damaging. It's frustrating. The New York Times assigned my book for review to a man named Nathan Glazer, who is a warhorse of the neoconservative movement, who's been damning people who protest vocally for his entire career. So that's not even assigning a review. That's assigning a damnation in advance. The Wall Street Journal did the same thing with another right-wing critic. I'm used to this, and I can take it, but we're fighting a real powerful enemy here, and not so much in the right-wing media. That doesn't surprise me. But in the allegedly centrist or liberal media, there's a kind of awful game being played right now, which is, yes, we honor Dr. King on his birthday every year, and yes, we, you know, write nostalgic stories on the anniversary of the Brown decision. And yes, we love to do feature stories on some upbeat ghetto school that's temporarily doing a little better than the rest. But otherwise, we refuse to confront the fact that we are reverting to an apartheid schooling system. We never use words like that. And when people like me use such words, we get gently rapped on the knuckles because such language might actually provoke people to do something about it.
Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about a review that appeared in Columbia Journalism Review. Linda Perlstein, who wrote the review, suggested that there were two problems with how the press covers public schools, particularly poor schools. One was a question of access. Administrators, principals are loath to open their doors to reporters for reasons that I think are arguably understandable. But at the same time, she faced personally editors who were hostile to the idea of even bringing up some of these issues. She recalled that when she was an education reporter at the Washington Post, again, a paper that enjoys a somewhat liberal reputation among some, she pitched a story about the resegregation of schools for a package they were doing on the anniversary, of Brown versus Board of Education, and the editors deemed that just an inappropriate subject for the time. I imagine that doesn't surprise you all that much.
No, I'm not surprised at all. One national TV network producer who was talking to me recently for one of the most influential shows, I can't name the person, said, "I talked with my bosses, and they're a little scared of you." Very interesting. I'm not an outrageous person. My book is carefully documented. I put all the documentation in the back of my books because the book is a narrative and I want to tell a story. I've heard this in many ways. People, whether it's editors or sometimes the writers themselves, they're very reluctant to touch this. And what some newspapers do is they'll find a conservative black journalist to sort of sweeten the story by saying, no, we don't need to talk about things like apartheid, total racial isolation. We don't even need to talk about gross inequality in funding. Instead, let's concentrate on a couple of boutique schools in a particular city, which because of unusual circumstances, usually because of a charismatic principal or something like that, suddenly was able to pump the test scores a few percentage points. And so they do little success stories, and then they say, all we need to do is replicate this on a larger scale, and the problem will be solved. And, you know, essentially they're saying, so we can have happy segregation. And what they tend to do also is, if there's a sudden blip in the scores, if, you know, the fourth grade scores go up a couple percentage points in New York or some other city, they'll make big front page story out of this. Test scores up for minority kids. And again, the message seems to be, if you'll just follow the initiatives of President Bush and test these kids relentlessly, which is basically what the Bush agenda is about, you know, test these kids and drill them all year for their tests and hire private companies like Kaplan and Princeton Review to prep them for the test, that'll solve the problem. And then what we always find is that a couple years later, in an obscure story, it will say test scores down. These are always false gains. These are what I call testing gains, not learning gains. And the way I know this is because I meet the same fourth graders 4 years later when they're in eighth grade, and usually they can't write a cogent sentence or read a simple textbook. Indeed, by the time black and Latino kids get to 12th grade, if they get that far, because there's a colossal dropout rate, their average reading scores are about the same as those of white seventh graders. So all these are false promises, and the newspapers recycle these false promises again and again and again in order to avoid the main truth. And the main truth, which they dodge by a very convenient defect of vision, the main truth is that segregated schooling is the longest-lasting failed experiment in U.S. social history. We've had 110 years since Plessy versus Ferguson, and segregated schools have never been equal to the schools that serve the mainstream of America. They never were in the century just past. They never will be in the century ahead. And that's why my book speaks directly to activist teachers, idealistic teachers. There are tens of thousands of marvelous young teachers in these systems, and very angry older teachers, too. And also speaks to young people who are still in college and graduate school, and doesn't just appeal to them to, to care about this, because care is a favorite word of inert liberals. I'm not criticizing liberals. I'm a liberal, but, I mean, there's a kind of weary type of semi-liberal who loves to say, well, at least the least that we can do is care. And this always infuriates me, because what they really mean is the most that we intend to do is care. And I tell people in my book and at these mass rallies I've been holding, caring isn't enough. If you're going to honor people like Dr. King and Bob Moses, who for our younger listeners was one of the great heroes of the early civil rights movement, if you're going to honor the martyrs of the civil rights movement like Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, who were murdered in Mississippi by the Ku Klux Klan, if you're going to honor Rosa Parks, don't just do it by reading sappy stories about them to your kids in fourth grade. Tell your kids the way to honor these people is by emulating their courage. And that means having the nerve to go out and march and protest and sit in and do whatever it takes, no matter how disruptive, as long as it's peaceful, to force this issue on the national agenda and to compel our political leaders to look this issue right in the face and to ask them the question bluntly, are you willing to live in an apartheid society in which the game is rigged from the starting gate against the poor? Or are you going to live up to the principles this nation says it stands for?
Jonathan Kozol, looking at federal education policy, No Child Left Behind, enjoys praise or support from a pretty broad media constituency. Even liberal commentators who tend to disagree with the Bush White House on every other issue are fine with their education policy. You write in Shame of the Nation that the media are often plenty eager to tout the latest uptick in standardized test scores. You've touched on that already here, particularly when they show a narrowing between white and non-white students, the much-discussed achievement gap. Why did these stories land on the front page while these other issues that you explore in such detail go begging for media interest?
Well, one reason is that the press, even at its most sincere, and I'm not attributing invidious motives to education writers, they are always told to look for signs of progress. You know, sort of a typical story is a flame of hope within the ashes. And so, you know, typically anything that can be inflated into the illusion of success within the box of segregation gets lots of attention. The fact of the matter is that the president's testing bill is officially known as NCLB, No Child Left Behind, though teachers call it No Child Left Untested, is based on the delusion that if you just make life hell for kids by testing them obsessively, that this will be a nice substitute for equal opportunity. It ain't. And I'm telling you, I don't know what distant ivory tower liberals are saying about this, because I simply don't read boring think tank reports. They're no fun to read. But I know what teachers think. Teachers tell me, number one, this obsessive testing is of absolutely no use to teachers because the results almost never come back until the following summer. So the president says something to the effect that all we're trying to do is help Miss O'Brien learn where little Susie's weaknesses lie so she can help little Susie. But, you know, I don't know what planet the president's on, but these test results never come back in time. By the time they come back, the child's in the next grade. Secondly, it's forcing teachers to teach obsessively and exclusively to the tests. And I describe in my book just horrendous situations where, you know, in one case, a marvelous young teacher, wonderful, wonderful, altruistic young teacher, was steeped in civil rights traditions, the kind of teacher I'm always recruiting to go into the inner city schools, was teaching fifth grade in the South Bronx, and she had to spend virtually a quarter of the year doing nothing except drilling kids for exams. So what this does is it's driving out the best teachers, because really, wonderful teachers who got good education in good suburban schools and know what education is refuse to accept this role of being like drill sergeants for the state. And a lot of these schools are inundated with business and corporate language and vocabulary. The teachers in some of these schools are told to put up signs where they call the most successful children in the class best workers. They use the term workers. Sometimes they put up signs assigning every child to be a manager of some sort. I was in one totally segregated school where second graders had jobs like blackboard cleaner manager, waste paper basket manager, line manager. I couldn't dream what line manager meant. It sounded like a Ford factory, but it turned out that meant manager of lining kids up, instead of just saying that was her little job. And they even had earnings charts for writing good sentences. So really wonderful teachers who have any kind of, you know, deeply intellectual education, who have gone to top suburban schools, find this abhorrent, atrocious. They didn't come into education to be branch managers for global corporations. And so they quit. And they either end up in the top suburban schools or they give up entirely. And as their parents tend to pressure them to do, they go to business school or something like that. They figure, well, if I'm going to have to talk business language, I might as well go into business and earn real money. And good teachers, you know, a good teacher can't come into a class and write up on the blackboard, I read my kids a wonderful poem of Langston Hughes or Gwendolyn Brooks, and they loved it. No, because love has nothing to do with it, because that's not going to show up on the tests that have to be given. Instead, she has to say something like, I used a poem of Langston Hughes to deliver the following three skills that are going to be measured on state exams. It's just to write exactly what they are on the blackboard. A lot of these schools have abolished recess, so they'll have more time drilling kids for exams. And one district, they abolished nap time from kindergarten. Kindergarten kids were taking high-stakes tests. This has been a nightmare. And President Bush, you know, whatever his intent, I'm sure he doesn't understand any of this. Sure, he takes his advice from others. But essentially, you know, he's turning teachers into accountants. And he's making the school day miserable for children. And he's taking away any sense that the purpose of learning is to enjoy the culture, that the purpose of reading is to enjoy a book. Instead, everything has to have an immediate utilitarian payoff, an earnings chart. Always in these schools, there's a lot of emphasis on training these kids to be useful workers in the American economy, but always at the lowest possible level. I'm in schools in which black and Latino girls are channeled away from academic courses, these are high schools, into vocational programs like hairdressing and sewing, even when they ask to take academic classes. So we don't just have an apartheid school system now, we have an apartheid curriculum. And no child left behind should not just be doctored and toyed with and beautified a little bit. It ought to be abolished. It ought to be reversed. And all the money that's being wasted on this sociopathic agenda of turning little kids into examination soldiers ought to be used instead for something that will actually help them learn. If I were education secretary, I would take every dollar that's now being squandered on absolutely useless testing and measurement of little children, and I would transfer all that money into a program of universal pre-K. 3 years of wonderful pre-K, that means preschool education for every poor child in America. And where we don't have that in the typical inner city schools, virtually less than a quarter of the kids get even half a day of preschool. It's outrageous. I mean, there's an old expression I've always loved. You don't fatten your lambs by weighing them. But all we're doing now is weighing these lambs, and that's how I think of these little kids, because they're so innocent and vulnerable and sweet kids. They're nice kids. We're weighing them, but meanwhile, we're starving them of what they need in order to prevail.
Now, finally, Jonathan, you write and you speak about big city newspapers that virtually ignore and literally ignore the schools in their own backyards. And you can sort of imagine what a newspaper editor might say to you, that these are problems that are intractable and unsolvable. You're talking about poverty and racism. I'm the editor of one metropolitan newspaper, or I produce one television newscast every night. What possible effect could I have on changing these literally unsolvable problems? What would your response be to them?
My response would be, why the hell does a newspaper exist unless it's going to be faithful to that famous slogan, to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted? You know, our major newspapers do a lot of very aggressive and clearly advocacy-type writing in order to, for example, create a huge market for the new fashions every year. In New York, good God, the New York Times sometimes sounds as if it's in the business of, you know, selling clothes, the spring collection. And if they didn't write these stories, clothing companies would not sell as many clothes as they do, and then wouldn't be able to take those full-page ads in the New York Times every Sunday. So obviously newspapers believe, editors know, that they can influence the preferences of their readers. This is a decision not to enter an area that might antagonize some of their most privileged readers.
We've been speaking with Jonathan Kozol, author of Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. Jonathan Kozol, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or would like to hear other Counterspin broadcasts, you can do that at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.